Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein with another conversation. Today we have C.R. Wiley, Chris Wiley, who is a pastor in Manchester, Connecticut, and a writer of fiction and nonfiction. His essay, Manual Manhood, appeared in the June 2018 issue of First Things. He has a new book out that goes under the title, The Household and the War for the Cosmos. That's our topic for today. Welcome, Pastor Wiley.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's great to be with you.
All right. You know, the subtitle there, Recovering Christian Vision for the Family, that's pretty clear. But your title has quite a striking polarity, The Household and the War for the Cosmos. What does that polarity suggest?
Well, I think that that's a connection that almost is never made. The cosmos being the highest level of order, and I guess maybe the household, if we're not talking about, you know, our human bodies being a much lower level of order. And there's a relationship between the two. And so I think that's been lost on us. And I think the title is intended to at least get at that connection.
I presume you mean that the war going on over the cosmos, the war on our reality, is fought first within the household. Within the family,
that's right. It's a, you know, at the level of in the ground where we are. Of course, there's a war for the cosmos that the Lord Jesus fought and won, and that is recorded for us in Ephesians, or it's described for us there. And the book, you could say, is a kind of an exposition of Ephesians and how that is. It sort of plays itself out in our lives. You know, for example, you know, that description of the Christian's armor at the end of Ephesians. And I think most of the time, preachers in the evangelical world, which is where I am, treat that as a kind of addendum, sort of like, oh, and by the way, this is the Apostle Paul. I'm in prison, and but I saw this Roman soldier over there, and his armor made me think of these, you know, these things that I think could help you in, you know, your daily life. And my sense is that the whole book of Ephesians, the letter to the Ephesians, is building to that point. This is not an addendum. This is kind of what he's been getting at. And right before that, you have the household codes. And again, that's often treated as something, well, if it's not treated as an embarrassment and just sort of skipped over, it's treated as just another one of those things. Oh, and by the way, you know, make sure you run your households well. But if you look at the letter to the Ephesians as a whole, everything holds together. And that's what I'm trying to get at with the title of the book and with the book.
The way it holds together, it seems to me, is it's patently obvious. The idea that if you're going to approach the world, then the world really begins, you know, inside. The world begins in the very close quarters within which you spend so much of your time. And, you know, it almost recalls to me, you know, the Jordan Peterson line that says, you know, before you go out and save the world, clean up your room. Which is a trivial way of putting it, but he doesn't mean that in a trivial way. He's actually quite serious about that.
Oh yeah, I think you're right. You know, you kind of build from there, and I think that's right. And I think one of the things that we tend to do in the modern, you know, in the modern world is we divide everything up, and everything is sort of this. We kind of look at them as discrete domains that really don't have anything to do with other domains. But that's certainly not the way ancient people thought. Both in the classical world and the biblical world, everything is kind of leads to everything else.
You talk a bit about, I don't want to get too personal here, but you talk a bit about the household in which you grew up, and that has certainly rendered you sensitive to a lot of these issues. What was going on in your household, if you don't mind?
Yeah, no, I don't mind. I mean, I've talked about it, openly in different places. I grew up in the home of an academic, and this was in the 60s, early 70s, where everybody was, tuning out and dropping out and tuning in, I guess. I can't remember what O'Leary said, but anyway, yeah. But the whole that line, and it's true. And I remember that world. And so people, were really getting into themselves and sort of disconnecting from other things, including their families. And so our family broke up when I was about 11 years old, and I was pretty much on my own from that point on. I was a ward of the state for a while, and lived in projects and stuff like that.
You had to leave the house? You didn't stay with one parent?
Well, I did, but my mother was not well mentally, and she was addicted to psychotropic drugs, and it was just a bad scene. So I went into foster care for a while, because she couldn't be trusted with us, my sister as well.
And your father, he didn't want to protect you from that. He was doing his own thing.
That's right. He checked out. He had deserted us. He was gone, and so. During those years, those teen years, there was no male presence in the home. My father wasn't at home, but even before that, it was spotty. So it was because of those things that I faced a lot of challenges that I wouldn't have faced otherwise. But also, I was I felt at a very personal level the importance of the and the significance of the household.
What was the foster home? Was it a relief? Was it a reprieve? What was it orderly?
Well, it was an odd setting. This particular family had not just me, but a few foster children in their care, but they had a very clear sort of line between, the kids that were being cared for in foster care and their home life. And looking back on it, I understand that. I don't have any criticisms for regarding that. But that it wasn't like going into a home where I learned a whole lot. It was more or less this was kind of a holding place for a while for me. So it was through the and I mentioned this, I think, in my article for First Things. It was during that period of time that I came to have faith in Christ through the work of a little blue collar evangelical church that I'm pretty sure almost 100% voted for Donald Trump in the last election. But it was in that place that I encountered men who were really kind of sort of they demonstrated that Norman Rockwell's vision wasn't just fantasy. There were actually people out there who lived the way that he depicts in his illustrations for Saturday Evening Post and stuff. So it was that kind of world. And these were guys who worked on their own cars, fixed up their own houses, worked in the factories, sort of guys who's that were depicted in The Deer Hunter, if that old film, if you know what I mean.
I remember one point you made in that essay where you talked about working in construction and working with different kinds of construction equipment. And one thing that a lot of people, I think, in the intellectual world especially, don't realize that you brought up is that if you're on a construction site, the intellectuals, the academics, the white collar people will look at this and see kind of a jumble of construction workers. But in truth, there is an extraordinary hierarchy on a construction site, on skill and experience, and I mean the structure of command is very tight. And I did a little construction work when I was a teenager, and I was just really a gopher. Go carry that stack of materials to make cupboards out of. From location X to location Y. And it was a big, heavy pile, and all I did was go pick one piece up and move it to another. So that I came into the very lowest point on the pole, but that's what happened. And you learn very early on that there is a very rigid structure to that, that kind of place.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's, and that's how it always begins. You know, so you're not being picked on or anything. It's just, that's where everybody starts. And yeah, and you work your way up as you're given opportunities to try new things.
And that this actually, I mean, I came out of a very chaotic household myself. And there was, I was, you know, it was boring work, but it was orderly, right? It was very clear and it was rational as well. And you know, that was where sort of I worked in restaurant kitchens and fast food places. And that's where you learn how to do your duty, right? Because when the household isn't doing that for you, then the workplace. But fortunately, you know, a lot of us, all of us in high school, we wanted to work, right? We wanted to go out and make our own money for one thing. But also, this was part of the process of growing up and learning how to handle life.
Right, right. Yeah, and in those settings, oftentimes, there's no regard for your feelings.
Feelings? I mean, I worked in one kitchen with my brother, my twin brother, and they could never tell us apart. So they just gave us one name. And I actually can't give you the name on the air. So this is a family program, so I can't tell you what my name was. But that was just our name for you know, a year working there. And you know, we didn't take it personally.
No, because you saw other people being treated the same way.
We were just the lowest level of dirt.
That's right. That's right. You feel like saying, okay, you treat me like a dog. Should I bark?
Yeah. Hey, you know, that's what I am here. I was making $1.90 an hour back then in 1974. So, okay, you say one thing. The Bible is a, quote, handbook for households. How so?
When we think about the household today, we think about, you know, the household as a place to retreat from work. It's a place where we get away, you know, where we relax at the end of the day, we crash, we surf the internet, we maybe watch Netflix, whatever. But that's not the way households worked up until the Industrial Revolution, which means for the vast majority of, you know, the history of civilization, a household was a working concern. It was a going concern, and it was a place where work was performed. And that's why we use the word economy today. It comes from the, you know, two Greek words, oikos, nomos, house, oikos, house, and then nomos, law. So it was the house law that ordered the daily affairs of people. And it was, those daily affairs included, you know, gathering wood for the fire or getting the coals stoked for the forge, you know, bringing in the cows, all these different kinds of things that made you know, a household a place that produced a living.
Right, right. I mean, think of the metaphor, you run a household.
Yeah, and so when we think about households in that way, then, you know, sort of the blinders, you know, the scales fall off our eyes, at least they did for me, and I look at the Bible and I see it everywhere. You know, when we think about the Abram's household or the household of David or whatever, you know, it's everywhere. And so what you have there is a handbook for households and terms of, you know, how do you order your daily life? How do you work with other people? How does all of this serve God? How does all of this reflect the kingdom of God? All of these things.
The household, I mean, a marriage, a family in a household in an average 18th century location, usually out in the country, everyone is working and everyone has a role and everyone is contributing. And if they don't, then the household suffers. You know, you can't run a household if you don't have a kind of a delegation and orderliness and separation of labor and so on for all the right reasons.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, and I think one of the reasons we have a crisis of authority in our households is they've lost their clear purpose. You know, when a child is told in a working household, even today, you know, if you have like a family farm or if there's a family business and the father says, okay, go and bring in the cows, you know, and a kid says, no, I'm not going to do that. Well, then the father's response is, well, first of all, the father would probably get mad, but father would probably say, well, then we're going to have some problems if you don't do that. There's got to be some practical consequence. There are going to be consequences if you don't do what I just said. I'm working over here on this. I need you to do that. So now today it's like clean your room. Well, why? Who's going to see that? I don't mind a messy room, that kind of stuff. Or, study your homework or you won't get into XYZ elite university. And a kid says, well, I don't want to go to XYZ elite university. I want to play video games, So, there's a loss of the sort of the practical sort of justification for the authority of parents and when we don't have a working household.
And a lot of the achievement, parents, the work is the child, everything about the youth is about homework. And which is to say, the work that is going to lead you out of the household into another place. And that really is the child's job. And it's just separate from the operations of the households. You don't need to do your chores. You got a lot of homework to do.
Right. And what's implied in that is that important things happen someplace else. And this is just the place we go to rest so that we can go do important things.
You spent a lot of time on the word cosmos.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that went with my last book, the one that preceded this book, which was entitled Man of the House, I'd get into the practical stuff. But I as I was working on that book, I realized that there's another dimension to this, which is the cosmic dimension, which is what this book is trying to get at. So, we live in a day when everything is justified in subjective language. So everything's about me and what makes me happy and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not talking about happiness in the Aristotelian sense. This is just in the emotive sense or whatever. So, what I try to accomplish in Man of the House is I wanted to help, people who, have families get out of that, get out of their heads, sort of see that the practical reason we even have households in the first place, or at least the way we used to think of them or how they used to function. And then I realized that, the Bible, that's only half the story. The other side of it is that in some real sense, our households reflect a divine economy, a cosmic economy. And that, we can go at that two ways. We can say, we can do the Freudian thing where we say, we have a father in heaven because we're projecting into this, into the sky, a father figure because we're afraid, da 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 da, Feuerbach, all that stuff. Or we can say, what Paul said, the reason we have fathers on the earth is because we have a father in heaven. So the projection is working in the other direction. And that's what you get in Ephesians chapter 4. So I said, okay, sometimes when we maybe can't justify everything we do in a household because of practical need, because we do live in a world where a lot of things are being done outside the household that are being done pretty well, pretty good. So what other reason why would we want to order a household? So that the authority of parents is respected and so forth. Well, it's because it reflects a divine order. And that's why the cosmic thing is there.
I have to read a little section because I think our listeners will enjoy this. This is a little section called "Welcome to the Cosmos," and you go back to a PBS television series that was aired entitled "Cosmos." When did that air? Was that the late 70s or early 80s? I'm trying to, because I remember when that came out, and you say, "I can recall the sensation that the original broadcast created." It was sensational. Everyone watched this show on PBS. It was something of a coming out party for celebrity scientist and atheist Carl Sagan. Sagan revealed the hidden agenda that informed the series when he famously intoned in the introduction, "The cosmos is all that is or was or ever will be. Our feeblest contemplations of the cosmos stir us. There is a tingling of the spine, a catch in the voice, a faint sensation, as if a distant memory of falling from a height. We know we are approaching the greatest of mysteries." Your comment on this. It was a very clever opening, and we should give Sagan credit. But we should also note that he plagiarized it. It was an echo of the words of Christ in Revelation. the line you were pointing out, all that is or was or ever will be. That's Sagan. Here's you. Christ in Revelation, I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty. We should also hear a little bit in Paul as well. Now that brings you back to the Ephesians. So interesting, Sagan the atheist, who became celebrated. Everyone knew who Carl Sagan. Everyone would mimic. Remember the patterns of it was billions and billions of stars. And he was an outspoken atheist. Remember how he predicted that within 20 years we would discover life in the universe besides ourselves. He was absolutely certain that we would encounter life, and that this would actually for him be proof positive of his atheism. Well, that hasn't happened since then. But interesting, he still has to borrow the language of religion in order to talk about the created world. Now, your criticism is his sense of creation is all natura naturata. It is just sort of inert matter obeying physical laws of some kind. But cosmos signified much more for Paul, Saint Paul, and as you say, his Roman audience as well. What was the bigger definition of cosmos?
Well, it was an order. It was a divinely instituted order. That's kind of the irony, I think, of the title of Sagan's program. Because, you know, Sagan, I don't know if he understood this. I imagine he did. You know, when we think of Sagan's cosmos, it's more of an equilibrium. It's not it's certainly not an order that's been instituted by an intelligence. That's the whole point that he's, you know, sort of struggling to denounce or to get away from.
Right. You put it, the ancients understand cosmos as having verticality. Right, it always had a top. Sagan's cosmos doesn't come with a top. It has no normative vertical dimension whatsoever. It is just space, as in outer space.
Yeah, and I think that unfortunately, that's kind of seeped into the way people think about, you know, the creation that we dwell in. But we still retain all of these all this language, you know, that we've inherited, and we can't do without it. And Sagan's not the only atheist guilty of this. I was just reading about Derrida today, you know, Nietzsche. All these guys, you know, steal freely, you know, in terms of their language. Because they're trying to infuse their philosophies with some value. They want us to think what they say is more valuable than what we currently believe or whatever.
You imply that one of the victims of this reduced understanding of existence of the cosmos is that even believers end up accepting it and confining faith into what you call a, quote, heart religion. Can you define what is a heart religion?
Well, you know, it's I in the book I use that well-known, you know, hymn, I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses. I'd sing it for you, but it's too mawkish. But the idea is that, you know.
Give us a couple of lines, actually.
I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses, and the voice I hear falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses, and he walks with me and he talks with me. And then it goes like that. The idea is sort of this, you know, you got this intimate connection with this very sort of Gnostic Jesus, and you withdraw from the world. And so most of the Christians that I deal with who have this experience think of the universe outside of their hearts in the terms that Carl Sagan uses. So they have a personal relationship with Jesus and Carl Sagan's cosmos.
Right. Right, which to me isn't just a wall of separation between church and state. It's a wall of separation between church and reality, right? External reality, I should say. Everything becomes internalized. Everything becomes sentimentalized, as well. Like as you get in that song. But you said that song that you have served at funerals or attended funerals, very popular?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I was on Cape Cod, I was pastor there. I buried lots of folks because, you know, it's a retirement. It's a place where people go to retire. So that was the second most requested hymn after Amazing Grace.
We need more piety. And you call Ephesians a, quote, we have a handbook again, a handbook for guerrilla piety. G-E-R-R. What is guerrilla piety?
One of the things that is kind of intriguing about New Testament studies is that many liberal scholars are very aware of the way pius or pietas functioned in the classical world as sort of the ordering, you know, sort of what they would refer to as an ideology, you know, to hold, you know, a way of life together. That's pretty much lost on most conservative commentators, at least that I've seen. But I think the liberals are right. I mean, when you look at, you know, the first century, and you think about Caesar Augustus and, you know, his marriage laws and just, you know, the entire, you know, you think about the Aeneid, you know, which was something that had been commissioned by Augustus, and at the center of the Aeneid is an Aeneas Pius, and he's, I know he, that's his appellation. That's what he's known as. So this is the value that in the ancient world was, it wasn't going to the garden alone. It was with Jesus. It was, you know, doing your duty. And the image in the first century that conveyed this was Aeneas fleeing Troy with Anchises, his father, a cripple, on his back and holding his son by the hand. And, you know, so you've got the three generations there. And so doing your duty to your father, to your progeny, you know, doing what's required, not because you feel like it, but because it's required, it's demanded. That's pius. That's piety in the ancient world. That is not what comes to mind today for most people.
Right. And I'll add, you go to that scene and you go also into the fact that he loses his wife when he leaves the city and his son's mother by mistake. So he goes back to try to find her, to rescue her from the burning Troy, and she's gone. She's dead. But her ghost confronts him and she actually tells him, do your duty. You must commit yourself to the necessity of maintaining the line.
That's exactly right. And as I try to show in the book, there are significant parallels with the story of Abraham in all of this. And so when the Christians in the empire and the Jews, who also were subject to the Romans, try to explain their way of life to their neighbors, they would say, hey, we're as pious as you. In fact, we're more pious than you. That was their argument. So, and I think they made a good case. And I think it had a role in the success of the church in the first, you know, in the early centuries of the church.
All right. Well, there are many other great episodes in the book. I'll say it again. The Household and the War for the Cosmos. The subtitle is Recovering a Christian Vision for the Family. You have a preface by Anthony Esselin in the book. Pastor Wiley, thank you for joining us.
Well, Mark, it's been great to be with you. I love First Things, and I appreciate all the work you do for it.
All right. Thank you.